Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 79 for July 25th, 2009. David Hennemeyer Hansen.
This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the weekly show of free, libre, open source software. That's what Floss stands for. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz. Usually about this time you're hearing Leo's dulcet tones chiming in, but we decided to give Leo the day off again so he could get caught up on all of the stuff coming back from China. Or actually, since I'm taping this slightly ahead of time, it may be that he's still stuck in China in some dark lit prison somewhere because he said he was a journalist. Anyway, I'm here holding down the fort all on my own. And if you happen to be watching the live presentation of this, which we do every Wednesday afternoon around 1:30 Pacific time, 20:30 Zulu, you'll see that I'm wearing the Floss t-shirt, the wonderful Floss t-shirt made by my friend now, Lori LeBeau Walsh. You can get those shirts by going to artandtechtees.com. She likes it when I mention that. So she has entirely decked me out for an entire week's worth of clothes, I figure from time to time it's okay to mention her. So that's how there is. And there's usually a lot of banter that goes on between the two hosts at this point. So I don't have a lot to do. So I'm just going to sit here and talk to myself. No, what I'm going to do now is introduce the guest. We have today a very special guest. I am so excited, looking forward to this interview. We actually scrambled to schedule this just in the last couple of days. And if you've been following my tweets, you've noticed that I just at the last second was able to put this show together. So I'm glad our guest had the time to take out of his busy schedule to do our interview today. He is none other than David Hennemeyer Hansen, often known as DHH. And the moment I've mentioned that, a few of you have going, oh my God, we've got him today. Yes, we have the creator of Ruby on Rails, that thing that has revolutionized the way web has happened in the last few years. Many major websites you might have heard of, Twitter, 37 Signals, those places, all are using Rails behind the scenes. So I'm really excited to be talking to David today. Let's get him on the line. So, David, where are we speaking to you today?
This is actually from my second bedroom slash office in my home in Chicago. So I am in the U.S. now, pretty much permanently. No more Denmark time.
And how long have you been in the U.S.?
I've been here for 3.5 years. I came over in December, 4 years ago?
Yeah, something like that. Yes. So how long have you been programming? Are you one of the people that started programming when you were like very young, or did you pick it up later in life?
Absolutely not. I did not start programming right away. I had a lot of programming friends growing up, but it was sort of looking at them that kept me off programming for a long time. I didn't get into programming really until I was in my 20s.
Really? What made you not want to be a programmer? This is curious.
Yeah, so I had a bunch of friends who I love dearly, but in many ways were exhibiting all the traditional programmer stereotype themes of being just overly focused on things I didn't think mattered. And at that time, programming perhaps was also a little bit different. Growing up, programming was assembler or C. I had a lot of friends in what was called the demo scene, which is, I think, mostly a European thing, where you had all these guys on the Commodore 64 and on the Amiga writing these really awesome visual displays of various kinds. And all of that stuff was usually in assembler. And I had absolutely zero interest in learning or doing anything with assembler. It just didn't make any sense to me at all. So I only really got interested in programming when I stumble across languages that made sense to me on the level that makes sense to me, which is at the very least high-level languages like Java or PHP or whatever have you. Anything that's above the, I have to dig around with pointers or I actually have to move memory spaces around, that stuff has absolutely zero interest to me at all. So I didn't start programming until I was in my late 20s. And even then, I didn't start programming because I wanted to be a programmer. I started programming because I wanted a few programs. And that was apparently the easiest way to get there, because the other way of getting programs is that you actually have to talk to programmers, which is surprisingly painful at times. So I found that the easiest way was just to pick it up and learn it myself.
Wow. And so what was your first programming language?
I started with, I'm trying to remember whether I first got exposed to ASP, which is the Microsoft Visual Basic stuff for web pages, or PHP. I think actually the first stuff I actually did personally, more of sort of a concerted effort, was in PHP.
Cool.
And PHP, I mean, I was always interested in programming for the website of things. I never cared for any other types of programs. I wasn't interested in writing desktop programs. I wasn't interested in writing anything else. I was just interested in getting information out on the web. So that was sort of the avenue I took to it.
So really for you, programming was just a tool to get to where you wanted to go. It wasn't really like the fascination that maybe some of us have with it, of being able to move ones and zeros around in real fancy ways.
Absolutely, at first. And this was in part due to sort of the languages I was probably exposed to. I mean, PHP, Java, ASP, those were the languages I actually did something in where I wanted the programs. I got a little bit exposure to C and a few other languages in college, but it wasn't until I discovered Ruby that I personally got interested in it to a level where I truly cared, that sort of the craft itself had meaning, and it wasn't just the end products that had meaning. So for me, it was very much about the tools, which is why it's always a little, you get this whole spiel about, oh, just pick the right tool for the job. Well, for me, there's a bunch of tools out there that, sure, you could pick for the job, but I would have zero interest in doing so. So to me, my interest in programming is very intimately married to a certain set of tools that give me just one particular experience of it. I have absolutely zero interest in doing programming if it means working with tools that I have no compassion for.
Now, you spent some time working with Java. What was your least favorite feature of Java?
Oh, there's so many things. It's really hard to pick out any individual parts. Just like I think on the flip side, it's hard to pick out any individual parts of what is it that you like about Ruby. The experience of a programming language is so much more the sum of its parts than looking at any individual thing and saying, oh, Ruby is awesome because it has blocks. I mean, that really doesn't tell the story. For me, the overarching theme for Java was just that it was so needlessly cumbersome. I would look at this structure and I would think to myself, there's going to be a million bajillion Java programmers out there who are sitting right now and writing the same freaking 10 lines to get the same one result. Why are we wasting world productivity like this? It just felt like this was a scam on the world, that we're sucking useful productivity out of the universe that could have been appointed to something meaningful. So in some sense, I was just enraged on a global level about this stuff, that it just seemed so completely mindless that we all had to do this stuff over and over and over again.
Sort of like giving a bunch of carpenters whose job was to screw things together just a bunch of hammers.
Exactly. I mean, why are we wasting all these people's time when there's so obviously a better way to do it? And it's not even finding out the better way. It's just looking at the repetition that I was seeing in Java programs. It's just, it did not make any sense at all. Like there was all this duplication that everybody was doing it the same way, or making changes in, or making differences in sort of ways that had no significance.
So along comes Ruby. What was your first exposure to Ruby?
I think I was reading an article in IEEE, I believe, by Martin Fowler or Dave Thomas. I was following both of those guys for some time. And I would read these articles by either Dave or Martin, and they would always preface their articles by, oh, I usually do Java or whatever it is by day because that's what my clients want me to do. But now I'm explaining this really interesting concept. Let me show it to you in a language I actually care about. And then they would go on and write about this, whatever topic it was, and use Ruby as the example code. And I found that just to be intensely interesting, that you'd have all these really smart guys who would prefer to use this programming language, but for some reason there was this magical force that was keeping them from doing it. And apparently that magical force was customer demand. And I was thinking to myself when I started working on Basecamp, which is the first product of 37 Signals, hey, I don't have a client. I can pick whatever I want. I mean, the only thing people care about is whether a web application comes out on the other side that does what they want in a reasonable amount of time and blah, blah, blah. Why am I not picking what all of these really smart guys would prefer to work with? It's probably a better experience than what I'm currently working with. So I sort of gave myself 1 week to see if I could just get up roughly to speed of where I was with PHP, which would otherwise have been the alternative I was going to use, and see if I could go from there. And I think it took like a couple of days of a little bit of frustration. And then after 1 week, it was, oh my God, this is awesome. And after 1 month, it was, oh my God, I am never going to touch PHP, Java, or any of those other environments I've been working with ever again, if I can help it. So I sort of pretty quickly got just that light bulb over my head saying, this is so much better. This is what programming is supposed to be like. This is what it's supposed to feel like to be a programmer. And this was probably the first time where I truly identified myself as a programmer, somebody who actually cared about the craft that they were doing.
So for those of us, the people at home that aren't familiar yet with what Ruby is, can you give us like an executive summary?
Sure. So Ruby is a dynamic language. I really don't like the notion of scripting languages, which is what Ruby's often being called, and what Perl and Python and these other languages, because it implies that it's only useful for tying stuff together, which is absolutely bullshit. It's useful for so much more than that. So dynamic languages, whatever. Anyway, the whole thing being with Ruby that it has a mission that I find to be really interesting. Matt's the creator of the Ruby language, formulated it at some point as Ruby is the programming language designed to make programmers happy. So that's the primary optimization target, is the human behind the keyboard. And when you have that sort of intention, there's a lot of tiny decisions that flow from that. It's a lot about the usability of the language. How does it feel to write a Ruby program? And what comes out on the other side? So if we go back to that Java example where we're seeing these repeated lines of boilerplate code over and over and over again, obviously that's one of those things that's not going to make you happy programmers. So when I program in Ruby, I very rarely see multi-line idioms, because if there is a multi-line idiom, it can be summed up and made shorter and usually arrived at something that can fit on one line. And so that's one part of it. The other part of Ruby, which I find intensely interesting to me as a sort of a framework builder, is the amount of leeway you have to mold the language. The Python guys often talk with sort of half scorn about the notion of monkey patching, which is the extension of existing base classes, like adding functions to string or to integer, whatever, that you design yourself. Well, to me, that's one of the absolute key features that makes me love Ruby, because the whole notion of Rails is that we're taking this general purpose language and then we're molding it into a slight special case language that's exceptionally well suited for creating web applications. And there are just things that you do with strings or with numbers or whatever that if you can change those classes and if you can suit them to your particular need, it's going to be so much nicer a ride. So that's one of the absolute key features that I truly enjoy. But it's in the same class as Perl or Python or languages like that. I mean, there's plenty of shared cultural affections in between those camps. I think we agree on way more things than we disagree on. So if you know of Perl or know of Python, Ruby is very similar, but it's also very different. I don't think that they're, just because you can do the same thing, or a Python program and a Ruby program perhaps would be roughly the same amount of, or lines of code, the way to go about it and the sort of the cultural deeper values of the communities are actually pretty different on a number of core issues.
Now, you've played with, obviously, a lot with Matz's implementation. Have you looked at some of the alternate implementations of Ruby?
I have, but only ever so slightly. I think this is, I love the fact what's going on with JRuby, what's going on with, there's a Ruby, Abby Bryant is working with somebody and there's a bunch of other implementations, and I find them interesting. I think it's great that that work is going on, but I have to commit that in some ways I'm a little bit indifferent, just because the Ruby 1.8 line is pretty damn good. Like, mm-hmm. The only thing that I'm really passionate about is that if they could make it use slightly less memory, and if they could make it slightly faster. But even that is a very, very low-level concern for me. Because the wonderful thing, as I was just talking about with Ruby, is that you don't have to wait around for the language designer to tweak the language in ways where you want it to go. When the core classes are open for extension, most of the interesting work that's going on can happen outside of the core release cycle. The mm-hmm. amount of stuff that we've shoved into the Ruby language through the active support extension library in Rails is staggering. And some people would even say scary. But I think that's why I don't really yearn for a new version of Ruby that much. Because whatever we can think of ways that would improve Ruby, we've done it already in most cases. Because I have a tendency to just care mostly about the API feel. Like spotting more of those idioms we were talking about, hey, I recognize these three lines over and over and over again. We can sum that up to a single method and add it to string. And boom, we're done.
Now, have you had a chance to play much with other languages like Perl and Python in your experience?
I have a little bit. I haven't written anything material. And I think in some ways I'm very mono language. That's not even a word, but I don't care. Once I find something that I truly like, which is the case with Ruby, I don't have that natural affection of Dave Thomas at some point said, you should learn a language every year. Well, I've been failing that test for the past 5 years. I just haven't cared. Like, Ruby has been so much enough for what I'm interested in. I haven't tapped it out yet that all of my energy has gone into that. So I keep sort of a half eye on it, but I don't learn that much unless I actually dig deep into something and try to program in anger, build something real. And I haven't had a chance to build something real yet. And I don't get a whole lot of enjoyment out of just doing toy programs in a variety of languages. That's just that's not my flavor. So not really.
Okay. As it's often said that Ruby owes part of its heritage to Smalltalk. Do you have any Smalltalk experience?
Not short of reading a fair amount of Smalltalk, and especially Kent Beck's absolutely wonderful Smalltalk Best Practices book, which is really a fantastic book, probably one of the best books I've ever read on programming. It's a tiny book, too. It's like 140 pages or something like that. And when I ordered off Amazon, it was like $85.
It's out of print.
Exactly. It's out of print, and there's just a few guys hawking the remaining copies. But it's a really good book, and it uses Smalltalk for all its examples, but almost everything in that book applies directly to Ruby, exactly because there is that close heritage between Ruby and Smalltalk. So there's just a lot of that Smalltalk wisdom that you can take directly and apply it to Ruby, which I think is wonderful. But Smalltalk in itself, I tried a few times with some of the images and so forth. It's too much of a different world. Like, it's too idealistic for me in some senses. It's too much, throw out everything you know, and I will show you a new world. And I just haven't been ready to take that red pill. I really like that Ruby is sort of, let's extract 80, 90% of what's awesome about that and inject it with some real world pragmatic approaches. Like, you can use the text editor you like. You can save files on the file system. You can do all of these things that interacts with the real world. You don't have to leave everything behind to jump into this to this Smalltalk world. And to me, the whole thing about the Smalltalk images, which is always just too confusing to me. What? There's all these different distributions, and you can they're not really compatible, and it just seemed like a hassle. And I just didn't have sort of the patience to wade through all of that. But I'm glad somebody else did. I'm glad all of that wisdom is available mostly to people using Ruby. So, yeah, again, not really.
Okay, long answer for not really. That's good. So how did you get? How did you come across 37 Signals? What was your relationship like at the beginning there?
Sure. So back in, I think, 2001, I had already been following 37 Signals for a few years. 37 Signals, well, a few years, meaning two, because 37 Signals was founded in 1999. But shortly after they were founded, they had this awesome website that was totally unlike any other website for a web consultancy firm I've ever seen. It's a very minimalistic manifest, actually. I think there was like 35 sort of essays on sort of the type of clients, the type of projects, the type of designs that 37 Signals was doing. I was just finding that uniquely interesting. And I was also finding the design aesthetic just very, very interesting. At that time, I wasn't full-fledged into the programming world. I was still sort of doing a little dabbling in web design and trying to learn from 37 Signals. Anyway, 2001... 37 Signals runs this web blog called Signal versus Noise. Jason Fried, the co-founder of the company and my partner, posts on the blog that he's trying to learn PHP because he wants to make this program. And I think he's having a question about pagination or something. And he's writing out in this blog, doing the lazy web approach to learning how to program. How do I do this? And I write him back a long letter explaining. We trade a few additional emails. And sort of at the end of it, he's like, actually, what if I just hire you to make the program instead? That would probably be easier than me trying to learn PHP. So here I am sitting in Denmark, seven time zones away, and I strike up this working relationship with Jason and with 37 Signals. And first we work on a product called Single File, which was actually the first published web application I ever got out there, which was manage your books online kind of thing. It never really took off. It had a core constituency of some really passionate fans, but never took off. Anyway, for the next like 3 years or something, I'm going to school and part-time working for 37 Signals doing client projects. They would do the design. I would do the programming. And then sort of the turning point for the company comes in 2003 when we decide to start working on Basecamp. And this is when I then get interested in Ruby. Sort of, we start working on Basecamp. I learn Ruby. I start creating Rails on the side as part of the Basecamp experience. And in 2004, we release Basecamp, and sort of things follow rapidly from there.
So, did 37 Signals specify that you build this in Ruby, or did you bring this idea to them?
Actually, I didn't even tell Jason for some time. I was like, you know what? This whole discussion is going to be a little awkward. I know he's comfortable with this whole PHP thing. Like, if I'm telling him I'm going to use a new language, he might freak out a little bit. So I think we actually made some substantial strides on the application before I even told Jason, hey, by the way, this is not actually PHP. This is Ruby. And he's like, okay, I guess. At that point, it wasn't really a choice. So I sort of just made the decision there that if I was going to make it, it was going to be in Ruby.
Well, I know that some of my friends have gotten Perl into very large corporations that very same way. So I guess it works.
I think it's actually the best way. There's absolutely no way a programmer can successfully convince somebody that they should give up what they already know for his own benefit. Like, basically, the sales argument would be, so, you know this PHP stuff where we've successfully delivered tons of applications before? Yeah, I don't really want to do that anymore because I'm sort of bored. So let me use this unproven technology that you've never heard of that you probably will fear will fail spectacularly to do the application instead because it'll make me feel better. No. that's not a very sellable argument. A very sellable argument is, though, see this running software? It's running on Ruby. Can you tell the difference? No, you can't. So it's pretty awesome, isn't it? That's sort of the argument that I think works a lot better in most cases.
It's interesting because most of what I hear when I hear about engineers being upset at their work environment, their all the tools and stuff they have to use, they were generally foisted upon them by upper management reading some magazine or listening to some advertisement. And whenever I have talked to people that are really enjoying what they're doing, it's always because they were able to sneak the technology in from the last conference they went to.
Yes, totally. Absolutely. There's just so much mandated technology out there that's being sold to people who don't have a freaking clue of whether they should use one thing or the other thing. So they take the one that has the most stakes and the most strippers, which tends to be from companies who have expense accounts to have salespeople who can sell them very expensive application servers over 6 months and wine and dine them with all this crap. So getting technologies in that doesn't have expense accounts like Ruby on Rails and Perl and Python and all this other stuff often requires getting in the back door because you have nothing to bribe upper management with. I think that's just the nature of the game. I'd say fortunately, though, there's plenty of alternative programming jobs out there now. I think it was more true perhaps in the past where your choice of being a programmer meant working for a big corporation. These days, there's so many startups, small companies where you don't have that traditional structure, where you don't have sort of purchasing managers whose only job it is to pick technology, which is a bullshit job anyway. So you don't have those people getting in the way. You have tons of companies that are filled with builders, people who will actually care about the tools that they're picking. So it tends to be less of a problem for these guys, which is, of course, also why those are the guys who pick up technologies like Ruby on Rails the first. In the beginning, we certainly didn't have all these enterprise users that we do now. We had all the small companies who were willing to take a quote-unquote risk on something because they felt it was the obvious good choice, regardless of whether no strippers and stakes were attached.
Well, I like the idea of the web being the great equalizer, making it possible for small companies to deliver some product without having to hire a big sales infrastructure and get into a distribution channel of some kind. And I often talk about the three guys in Starbucks as I'm talking about web development. You got the web programmer, the ponytail designer guy or gal, and the guy with the idea that brings them together. Mm-hmm. And those three guys meeting in Starbucks over and over again can generate a company with something like Ruby on Rails or Smalltalk Seaside or something like that.
Absolutely. And I think the wonderful thing about the web is that not only is it an equalizer on the business side of things, it's an equalizer for the technology. Before, if you wanted to write a piece of software, you would have to write it preferably in the native environment of that platform. So if you want to write something for OS X, you better damn well write it in Objective-C and use sort of the core infrastructure classes. And the same thing on the Microsoft side. You better damn well write it in .NET or whatever, because that's the native environment. The wonderful thing about the web is that it divorces sort of the notion of the native environment from the implementational technology. Any piece of programming language can spit out HTML and JavaScript, which means that you can build it in whatever the hell you want. It could be a tiny programmer. You can invent a language and you can start using it and your users will not know the difference. So it really is this great equalizer in the sense of allowing new technologies to spring up and get serious traction because they don't need those network effects. For me, Rails was just as good when we had 1,000 users as it is now when we have hundreds of thousands of users because it doesn't do anything different. Basecamp looks the same now as it did roughly 5 years ago in the terms of what it's generating, regardless of whether the platform was a lot smaller back then and it was just me working on it. So I think that's really, the web is exciting for on so many levels, but as an equalizer, both for businesses and for technologies, it's especially wonderful.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like people don't have to know that when they're going to, say, Basecamp, it's written in Ruby, and when they're going to Ticketmaster, it's written in Perl. They don't care.
Yep, totally. And that's just so awesome. Then the playing field becomes who creates the best business online, who creates the best website, who creates the best and most compelling experience. And we don't give two hoots about what you write in it.
So you created Rails during the building of Basecamp? Did you know it was going to be a separate framework at that point, or were you just simply fulfilling the task of Basecamp?
I didn't. So when I started building Basecamp, I was absolutely just building these blocks for myself. At that time, Ruby didn't have really just the treasure trove of frameworks that it does now. It had a lot of things, but it also had a lot of things that wasn't especially meant for web construction. And I came in with a lot of preconceived notions of how web development should be done. I came in with a lot of learned idioms from PHP of how easy so many things are in PHP to do, that if they weren't as easy to do that in Ruby, I damn well would want to change that. So it would be just as easy. So I started building all of these frameworks bits by bits. And I guess about halfway or two-thirds through, I was thinking, hey, I have a ORM now to talk to the database. I have a templating language to sort of format my HTML. I have a controller framework. I have all these frameworks, and I'm really enjoying what I'm doing right now. I've never had more fun doing programming than I had with the Ruby stuff and the Rails bits I was building. It'd be pretty selfish for me to keep it all to myself, wouldn't it? So I'm just thinking, I'm getting all these things for free. Ruby is free. All the infrastructure pieces, Apache, MySQL, Linux, whatever else you have, and all those pieces are free. It just felt like I'd be a dick if I then took the one ball that I had and just kept it to myself. So I just decided, well, the right thing to do would be to share it. And if other people like it, that'd be wonderful. But at least I would put it out there. So a few months before the release of Basecamp, I sort of decided that I was going to put something out there. But at the same time, I didn't want to just put something out there that was going to language just like a ton of other open source projects. If I was going to put something out there, I was going to put it out there with enough effort that it had a fighting chance to make a difference for people. So I think for 6 months, actually, after I had a completely working framework sitting on my hard drive, I said, screw release early and release often. I'm going to polish the hell out of this thing. I'm going to write the documentation. I'm going to build up some marketing sort of intensity around it. I'm going to do all of these things that a lot of open source projects do not. And as a result of that, they have a tendency to not get very far. I wanted this to have an impact. I wanted this for my time to be worthwhile. I was not going to put all this freaking effort into bundling this stuff up if that meant just two people playing with it for 5 minutes. I mean, that's freaking wasted effort. So it took about another 6 months of me talking it up, polishing it up, writing documentation, doing all these things before I felt, hey, it's good enough now to release it.
Now, at this point, was this owned as a work for hire by 37 Signals, or was it owned by your company, or... How did the ownership come back?
I just said to Jason, you know what? I'm going to put all this time into it. Mind you, too, when I started working for 37 Signals, and while I think I was working on Basecamp in the beginning, I was paid $25 an hour. Like, that was a fortune back then because the dollar was worth something, and I was a demo. Things have since changed. But I was still... aware enough that $25 an hour is not enough to own my mind. It's certainly not enough to own my passion. So the deal was that I would only bill 37 Signals for the working hours I put in on Basecamp itself. And then all the sort of extra polishing work I would put in would be in my own time. So I just said, this is going to be mine. I'm going to run with it. I'm going to put in the effort to it with it. So it's also going to be something that I control. And most importantly, just that I wanted to make sure that, especially in the beginning, that I could absolutely control the vision of where this thing was going to go. Which was also why, for I think at least a year, Rails had one committer, me. There's plenty of people submitting patches, but there was one committer, and I was that. Because I wanted to make absolutely sure that this had a clarity of vision, it had sort of a very targeted design. I did not want it to just become this sort of mess that in many ways was what drove me away from PHP. I think PHP is a wonderful platform for many, many reasons, but consistency of vision and design is not one of them. Like, it's just a grab bag of so many people injecting their own ideas into how this thing is going to be designed. I wanted something that was a ton more streamlined than that. And the only way I knew how to secure that in the beginning was, well, I'm going to be the one making the decision around it.
So speaking of the design, can you describe sort of, again, the executive summary of what the architecture of Rails is really about?
Sure. So the architecture of Rails is that it's going to be full stack, which means that this is not going to be just one piece, and then you have to go out shopping for another 10 pieces to build a web application. I wanted something where you had the entire box. With Rails today, just using Rails and nothing else, you can build an awesome application from the bottom up. And that meant including all the stuff to talk to the database, the templating, the MVC structure, blah, 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 blah. And the core reason of why I wanted to do this was because I wanted all the pieces to fit together just as well as sort of an integrated Apple stack. Apple products was definitely a leading inspiration for the design of this. Just how well the whole flow of the iPod works together with, it's not just the iPod. It's the fact that it's the iPod, it's the iTunes player, it's syncing with your library. It's all of these things that are very neatly integrated because every single piece knows about the other piece. So Rails was designed with that same approach in mind, that the whole flow was going to be awesome, that you weren't going to have these big cracks between the in the seams between the frameworks that you get with a lot of other technologies. It doesn't sort of include everything. You get that you have a lot of different camps and they have their own motivations, they have their own timelines, they have their own sort of priorities. But when you run everything as sort of, in some ways, one monolithic design structure, you get to control everything. And controlling everything is absolutely key to ensuring that perfect experience. So for me, it was... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this starts with the fact that I think that Ruby is actually, in most cases, actually the thing that's listing on port 80, right?
It's what?
The thing that's listing on port 80, I mean, you're actually starting with your web request all the way from Ruby forward. I mean, it's not
sort of. I mean, there's been sort of ways back and forth between that. When I started working with it, I was actually using mod Ruby, which is had its own list of problems. But for what I was using it for in the beginning, it was fine. So I was still using Apache. I mean, everything else then from Apache handing over the request and all the way through to pulling stuff out of MySQL was handled by Ruby and was handled by Rails in most cases. Like the whole end-to-end spectrum was like that. And I guess the other key sort of overarching theme is the notion of convention over configuration, which is really probably the number one design imperative that we have, which is... we're going to put the stack together for you, configure everything for you in a way such that if you're building an application that's put together just like most applications are put together most of the time, most decisions will be made for you. So one example I always pull out is what are you going to call the primary key in your tables? So when I was working with PHP and Java, every single shop, almost every single application would have its own naming scheme. Some would say they had the products table and then they had product ID. Other would have product underscore ID. Some people would have prod ID or PID or P capital ID. And every time somebody made a new design decision, it meant configuration. You now have to tell your models, your objects, how they're going to talk to this database table because it needs to know what the hell you call that freaking primary key column. And it just doesn't matter. Who cares what the primary key column is called? It just doesn't matter. It's going to have zero impact on the usefulness of your application. So the idea is, what about we just make that decision once? Let's just freaking call it ID and be done with it. If you call it ID, I can assume you're calling it ID, and then we don't have to talk about it again. And there are thousands of decisions just like that. Decisions that you could make a variety of choices. The choices just doesn't matter. What matters way more is the productivity you get out of not making them. So by just deciding on these conventions, instead of requiring you to configure everything from scratch, this is especially true with the Java frameworks. One of the sort of the jokes we had in the beginning was XML setups. That you'd have all of these struts and other Java frameworks that just required reams and reams and reams of XML setups, telling the system how that piece worked with that piece over and over and over again. And again, from this notion of you have thousands of programmers who are making the same stupid, meaningless, insignificant decisions every single freaking day, and it's a drain on productivity. Just decide it once. I mean, it just doesn't matter that much. Your ego just doesn't matter that much. Your intellect should be applied to something much more worthwhile than picking the name of the goddamn primary key table.
So you're relying a lot on good, well-chosen defaults then, but you do have ways of overriding all that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there will always be special cases. You'll have a legacy database. You'll have some guy who just really cares about what you call the primary key. And I mean, fine. All right. Let him have it. It's not going to sink the ship. But that's actually, it's also sort of a bathe and switch. So we had a lot of people coming to Rails, especially in the early days, with their own set of really hard-held beliefs about what things should be called or whatever. And the first 3 days, they'll try to reconfigure Rails to fit all of their conventions. And then after 3 days, they're thinking, God, this is a lot of work. Like, look at how simple my model could be if I just stuck with the Rails conventions. And then they convert all their stuff over to the Rails conventions, and they cut out a ton of configuration work, and everybody's happy.
Along with convention over configuration, I also see the phrase "don't repeat yourself" a lot with Rails. Can you describe what that means?
So "don't repeat yourself" is all about not having sort of the same intentions spread out in multiple places. Don't have sort of one configuration. Like if you're calling something, let's again take the example of the primary key. If you're calling that for ID, you shouldn't have to configure that in three different places that all have to work together and all have to be changed together. You should just pick one authoritative place to have that information stored. And then you can make changes from there. And it also sort of goes with the whole Ruby idiom of like, we don't want those Java boilerplate 10-line things. Like, that's repeating yourself. If you have the same idiom, if you have the same intentions, that should really be exceedingly a short expression. And that goes out throughout the entire framework. Just keep one place to sort of change those things and keep the idioms very short.
So the Rails is a web framework that you said earlier is an MVC. Can you fill that out a little bit? What's MVC?
So MVC is a model view controller, which is just basically a way of splitting up the logical parts of an application into sort of individual segments that make sense on their own. So the model part in an MVC application is where all the sort of what you'd call business logic is kept. Those are all the classes like post and category and author and all those things. Say if you're making a weblog, you'd keep all that stuff in the model, and you'd have all the logic about whether the author is allowed to make a post or so forth, and how the relationship between posts and comments work together. Those are all sitting in the model, so that's all the business logic.
That's typically mapped using an object relational mapper, actor
that's
record.
Very often backed by a database in some sense. Not always, but most of the time. And that's where in Rails we're using something called Active Record, which is this way of mapping database tables to objects and then decorating those objects with logic. And then the second part would be the controller part, which is basically the logic that accepts a request from the outside world. Like the user clicks the delete link. Now, what's supposed to happen? So the delete link goes into the controller, and the controller has a, let's say, post controller delete method. That delete method will first look up the appropriate comment, and then it will destroy that comment, and then it'll redirect the user to the index page, for example. All that logic about how the flow of the application and how the flow of the interface is going to work lives in the controller. And then the final part, the view, is all the UI that the user will see. So, for example, the index page has to be, I mean, in a web application, that's probably going to be HTML, and you have to have some way of decorating and filling that out. And you do that in the view. View is usually consisting of these various forms of templates where you mix logic with presentation and somehow ends up with sort of a dynamic UI. So you basically, you split those three parts up because it's much easier to maintain. You can test each of the individual parts by themselves, and you're going to have just some way of keeping your head straight. If you have any application of a meaningful size, if you just munch it all together in huge scripts that does all of that, it's going to be very hard to keep it all together in your head, to keep it logically separated, and it's going to be very hard not to repeat yourself. You're probably going to repeat yourself over and over again if you don't split these parts out.
One of the things I've noticed with a lot of the Rails applications is they seem to all, or at least for the predominant part, use RESTful URLs to do these mapping to the controllers. Is that something that was designed in from the beginning or something you stumbled across later on?
It wasn't designed in from the beginning. The whole RESTful approach is actually something the Rails community picked up on, 3 years ago or something. I had a presentation at one point at RailsConf where I introduced that we were going to do this in Rails because I had really gotten just enthralled with the idea of REST. And the reason I got enthralled with the idea of REST is exactly the same reasons why I like convention over configuration. REST is a set of very clear conventions about how you should structure your application that on the outside is just all about resources. It doesn't talk about the implementation of it. It talks about how URLs are supposed to work and how the HTTP verbs are supposed to be applied to get that. But if you let it seep into the framework just a little bit deeper, if you let it seep into the controller level, it can also have just a magnificent impact on the design of your application because it brings such a clarity to what's supposed to go where. Before I got sort of interested in REST, the one spot in my applications that would always get out of control would be my controllers. I'd have like, let's say, the global controller. Because the thing is, if you don't have the right vocabulary to talk about something, it's very easy to get sucked into these trash can notions, the sort of grab bag, the MISC library that just includes all these sort of functions you don't know where to stick anywhere else. Now, with the global controller, for example, in Basecamp, I think we still have a global controller in Basecamp. Like, it would control what the color scheme was supposed to be. It would control showing invoices. It would control all of these sort of things that have nothing to do with each other, that have absolutely zero cohesion internally. Now, the REST framework is saying, let's expose everything as a resource, which in my mind often maps very well to a single model, and let's expose four main verbs of it. And then you have like you have your get, your post, your put, and your delete. Like that framework, looking through the world in just sort of like those four things makes everything a lot simpler. Now, all of a sudden, looking at the global controller, how was I supposed to apply that to the global controller? Obviously, I couldn't. I had to start picking out these resources. So wait a minute. I should probably have a color scheme controller, like because that's the only way I'm going to fit get, post, put, and delete on it. Because if I'm just having a delete on my global controller, what's that going to delete? Is that going to delete the color scheme? Is that going to delete the invoice? So it gave you this vocabulary, it gave you those constraints, basically, of saying, there's no way you can make this mess. Like, this mess does not fit in a very nicely restful view of the world. So you have to clean up your goddamn mess. And the constraint would come early on. So, I mean, the global control didn't used to have all this bullshit. Like, it used to have just three methods. But just like the MISC library, three methods grows into 20 methods, grows into 50 methods, grows into 100 methods. And all of a sudden, you have like a huge mess. You have no idea how to clean it up and how it even got to be this messy. So the REST approach just gives you this discipline. It gives you this discipline of splitting everything out really early on. And it is a little bit cumbersome and it requires some getting used to. And I know, like, why are we doing this? Is this even worth it? Do users even care? Like, to be frank, I don't even care about the users. For me, this is an internal design tool. It's just, in some sense, just like a test-driven design is not really about the tests. It's a lot about the design that comes out of that. To me, RESTful web applications are the same thing. they're sort of about the web in the sense of, I mean, it's going to be a nicely behaved web citizen application you get out of it in the end. But the key benefit to me is the internal design constraints that it puts on things.
Wow, cool. So part of that then, in the idea of not having a lot of configuration to do, is that you're mapping these RESTful URLs almost directly then to the names of classes that are happening as controllers, right?
Yes, absolutely. So you say you map resources posts. Like that's the one line of configuration put in. That'll automatically know you're going to have a post controller, and that post controller is going to have a set of methods. So the index method is going to be called when you do a get on just the slash posts. The show method is going to be called when you do a get on slash posts slash one or any other integer. The destroy method is going to be called when you call delete slash post slash one. So you have this entire mapping scheme that's already set for you. It's this wonderful convention where all your controllers look the same. They all have the same methods. They all have index, they all have show, they all have destroy, they all have these things, and you don't have to configure that. There's no configuration going on between telling you, oh, how is this URL scheme actually going to map to my internal controller? No, because you already have this mapped out, at least for the 80% case, the default case of all these standard methods that most controllers have most of the time.
Now, the responses are coming back, obviously, in HTML. In order for the browser to understand that, you have some sort of templating language in Rails. Is that evolved over time, or did you pretty much have the entire design for it at the beginning?
So the templating language that I use for Rails is something called ERB, which is basically just mixing Ruby with HTML. There's a bunch of other templating languages out there that are more involved or more intricate or use more indirect methods of different things. But for me, the Ruby is a good enough language that can be used as a template language. That, to me, says a ton about Ruby. Because you cannot say, for example, the same thing about Java. Java is simply not a succinct enough language to be used as a template language. It's too verbose. The HTML would drown out in between all the needless Java code. In Ruby, the code itself is succinct enough that it's not going to drown out the HTML. HTML is actually more verbose than Ruby. Definitely not the case with Java. Java is much more verbose than HTML. So you have to have sort of that balance. And Ruby have enough of that balance, and it is a wonderful enough language that you can use it for templating. So I never found the need to come up with another language for that. There's a bunch of other reasons, and there's a bunch of other concerns for why you would want to do that sometimes. Say you have end users who are designing templates. You don't want to give them the full power of Ruby. I mean, that's sort of giving a toddler a lightsaber. You don't want that much power in his hands. Something bad is going to happen. So you have sort of more restricted template languages. You have languages that are for sort of for other styles where there's not that clear division between the Ruby and the code itself. There's something called HAML, which tries to make HTML less verbose. There's a lot of other approaches. I think there's something like 20 different template engines you can use with Rails. But the default one has been the same since day one, which is basically just HTML plus Ruby.
Almost as many templating languages as there are for Perl. What a deal.
Yes, absolutely.
Because they're both really good at string processing, and that's one of the things. Actually, we used to call it a rite of passage in the Perl world that everybody would eventually write their own templating language at some point. Same thing happening in Ruby.
It's a very popular thing to sort of dig into and write your own thing. It's one of the most popular and more where we just have so many choices. But it's very much a long tail. In the Rails world, there is Ruby plus ERB, and then it digs down really deep before you find the next templating language. I don't even know who number two is, but the vast majority will just use Ruby plus HTML.
And another part of the interface then that obviously a lot of us are concerned with to make it more interactive is JavaScript. How does JavaScript play in the middle of all this?
So when the whole Ajax thing blew up a few years ago, I sat down like, oh, this sounds like a bunch of hype, blah, 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 blah. And then I tried to create an application with it. It was like, oh, God. Like, applications are never going to be the same again. There's no way that people are going to go back to the old way of things. Once you've used an Ajax application where it's used correctly and gracefully. It's just such a more pleasant user experience for a certain subset of actions than the old way. So it became very clear to me that this was going to be an integral part of almost all web applications from this point out. So we made the decision really early on that Rails was going to take a stance on this. And we included actually one of the leading JavaScript frameworks, something called Prototype, straight in Rails. So when you install Rails, you automatically get a full Ajax setup. There's a bunch of helper classes for it. There's the built-in JavaScript library of Prototype right in the box. So if you just care about making things more dynamic, there's already a very clear path. You don't have to educate yourself on all the different JavaScript language or frameworks and how they all work and blah, 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 and how to integrate yourself. There is a clear path that you can follow. I think that's really important. I think that's one of the reasons why so many Rails applications, especially in the early days, came with Ajax when many others didn't. These days, there's a lot of other choices. There's plenty of Rails people who enjoy other JavaScript language or frameworks too, such as jQuery or whatever have you. And they can mix and match those things, and we're making it even easier to put those things in and make them fit well with Rails. But I think it's a very key thing, and I'm very happy to see that sort of the early jumping on that wagon really paid off. There was a lot of other web frameworks at the time who said, people can sort of do their own thing. This is not something that a web framework should concern itself with, blah, 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 blah. I actually remember having a conversation at, I think it was called Snakes and Rubies with Adrian Holovati of Django about this topic. And he was like, no, I don't think we're going to put that into Django. It doesn't fit. Why is JavaScript so hard? Which is like, dude, what the hell are you talking about? I hate JavaScript. Like, vanilla JavaScript without a library is one of the most painful things ever, because the DOM is such a pain in the ass to work with before somebody wrapped it in like 10 layers of sugar. So we wanted to wrap that vanilla JavaScript experience in 15 layers of sugar. Both the prototype JavaScript language, or I keep calling language framework. It almost feels like a language, actually.
Right.
The prototype framework to just wrap JavaScript itself. And then on top of that, we wanted to wrap it nicely in Rails too. Because it just, I did the first Ajax application I did was something called Ta-da List, where I actually wrote everything by hand. I didn't have a prototype library, a JavaScript library to do it. And it was just unbelievably painful. So I did not want to subject anybody else to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, once I discovered jQuery, I'm actually happy now playing with JavaScript. That and UE before that, but definitely made a difference to me. Yeah, definitely. Hey, so what's your development environment? How are you coding your Rails applications?
So I do everything in an editor called TextMate, which is actually an interesting story, because when I first came to the Mac, I started working for 37 Signals on a PC, I seem to remember, but I've luckily repressed all those memories. I moved to a Mac pretty early on, but there was really not a good editor at the time. I was using, I think, Project Builder or something, which is basically just a text field with no other help or support. And I was never into the whole Unix editor world of VI and Emacs. I sort of know my way around VI, but I'd prefer not to. Back when was this? It was probably around 2004. I had a really good friend in Denmark named Alan Elgo, who was working on a new text editor for the Mac. And he had already rewritten this text editor, I think, four or five times. And he was at the brink of giving up on the whole project. He was like, no, you can't. I need this thing. I need this text editor, because Project Builder sucks and nobody else seems to have a good text editor. And I'm not going to use the stablemate of the Apple text editors, which is, what's it called?
BB Edit,
that's right. I used BB Edit once and so, and it was like, this is from another time zone. It felt like this was from another time capsule. And definitely it wasn't to my style.
So well, hey, ran back on OS 7, so of course it's going to be from a different time
exactly,
zone.
Exactly, it was. And I mean, which was fine. I mean, there's obviously a lot of Mac users from back in those days. Back in those days, I had absolutely no allegiance to the Mac, though. For me, the Mac is all about post-OS 10. Mm-hmm. So I wanted something that had that feel to it. So I got really involved with Alan and worked with him over a couple of months to narrow down what exactly was TextMate going to do and get us to a point where we could actually push it out there, all for my own sales of interest, because I wanted to use TextMate. So it is still to this day the text editor I use, and I'm really happy with it. I course, it alluded to a few times, use everything on the Mac. So between just a terminal and TextMate, I'm pretty set for development environment.
And do you have a preferred version control system using SVN or Git these days?
We're all Git. Git is definitely Git is one of those things where I was a little skeptical up front, thinking like, does it really matter that much? But it does. Git totally does matter. So I'm really happy that in some ways I got dragged into it from SVN. I was pretty happy with Subversion, and I still think that Git is such a it doesn't have very good usability. Like, it's a very powerful tool, but sometimes you want to do a simple thing and you're like, what? I have to do these five steps? How does that make any sense at all? I think actually Subversion in many cases had a lot better usability, but it just there was just some things it just didn't do well enough. Git is just more powerful technology, even if it's harder to use. So Git is definitely a big part of the setup, and I love it these days. You keep finding these small things about Git. I remember the first time I discovered Cherry Pick. I'm like, wow, that's freaking awesome.
Rebase.
Bisect, Merge, or some of these other sort of sounds like they're exotic things, but after you use them just once or twice, you're like, how the hell did I ever get by without this stuff in the past?
Have you found Rebase-I? Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. It's just awesome.
Let's just reorder these and merge these two together and click it together.
It's pretty damn fantastic, which is actually similar to the experience I had with Ruby. When I first came to Ruby, there's so much metaprogramming in Ruby that you can do, where I was looking at all these internal things, especially around object space, and I was like, who the hell would ever want to use this? And it usually wouldn't be more than 3 or 4 days where I would sit with some programmer and be like, this is exactly why Matt's thought of that method. Like, oh my God, this guy's a genius. And sometimes you have that feeling with Git too. You have a problem and then you realize, hey, somebody actually thought about this and they have a really eloquent solution for it.
And there's also an overlap with Git and Rails, right? Isn't GitHub done in Rails?
Yes. GitHub is a Ruby on Rails application. And I think that's actually a big part of it too. Like there's a lot of other version control systems that are similar to Git in their structure, but only Git has GitHub. And GitHub is freaking awesome. We host the Ruby on Rails project on GitHub. I host all of my sort of personal projects on GitHub. GitHub is really sweet. And it certainly doesn't hurt that it's all done in Ruby on Rails, and the team behind it is absolutely wonderful. I was just out visiting them in San Francisco not too long ago, and if you're not already on GitHub, if you're not already using GitHub to use your to share your personal projects, you should absolutely sign up for an account today. It's completely free and so forth. The only thing you have to pay for is if you want private repositories. One of the best Ruby on Rails applications out there for sure.
Now, keeping it the list down to 20 minutes, can you tell me some other famous Rails sites that we might be familiar with?
Twitter is obviously one of the big ones. It sometimes was a mixed blessing. They had some performance issues for a while and so forth, but I still think it's absolutely a wonderful site. It's one of those other things where at first I was like, I don't get it. Like I was first shown Twitter when it was almost exclusive or was exclusively about mobile phones and was just about your friends. It was like, I don't care what Florian had for breakfast. Like, how is this useful to me? So I didn't get it for a very long time. But once you get it, which is usually the point when you find somebody online who's posting stuff that you care about, you're like, oh, my God, this is awesome. So that's one of the big applications. Yellowpages.com is another big application that's using it. Fulo, which is an app here in the U.S. for streaming TV and movies and so on, is using it, which is really cool. Genie, Ancestry, finding things. Shopify, which is actually a really awesome application by Toby and the guys from, what is it, Pixel Soup? He's one of the original Rails core members. Shopify is really a cool place if you want to set up a new shop for somebody. They basically took like something like Yahoo Shops and just made it awesome and made it feel like it was written in this century. So that's pretty cool. I'm looking sort of through the list here. We have a long list at rubyonrails.org/applications. There's Congregate, which is all about those Flash games, Rivalry, Knitting Community, 43 Things, which is one of the very early applications too, which is a really cool application I used for a while for tracking your goals in life. Mm-hmm. you basically make these lists of up to 43 things that you want to do in life, and you have all these people who can cheer you on and see your progress and talk to other people about the goals you're trying to accomplish, which is really cool. Urban Dictionary actually is I use that all the time to look stuff up that's written in Rails. That's just sort of a grab bag of some of the. There's, I mean, so many applications these days that I'm even having a hard time and often surprised. I'll learn that some application I'm using, like, oh my God, it's actually written in Ruby and Rails.
That's you can't tell by the REST URLs?
You can't always. There's a few clues I look for. I usually do a view source, and if they're timestamping their assets, like their images and so on, in sort of the standard way, that's usually the one I use for picking it up. But there's actually a fair amount of other frameworks and so on that's picked up the same RESTful naming schemes that we have for Rails. So it's a little harder these days just to tell it by the URLs. In the past, it was easier because we use something like /projects/show/1, which was a clear giveaway that that was a Rails application. Not so easy these days.
You should have put a little like a secret, steganography item,
and right. Link back to some site that I could then farm for Google creds.
So you mentioned briefly Twitter, there was a big controversy that came out when Twitter started rolling over badly, and they said, "Oh, it's because of Rails." Do you have anything you want to say about that?
I mean, the thing, it wasn't about Rails, but it doesn't even matter. Oftentimes, whatever language you write it in, what matters is the sort of the algorithm you use. I mean, mm-hmm. The worst algorithm implemented in assembler will be much slower than the best algorithm implemented in Ruby or any
faster.
Other language.
Faster.
Yeah, faster. Yeah. Yeah, not better. Faster. And I think that was exactly what was the case with Twitter for a while. They had some infrastructure pieces that were just not designed to handle that kind of uses that they were seeing in that kind of scale. And they got it under control and have been reasonably trouble-free ever since. And the other thing, too, is that Rails, as any other high-level application framework, is never going to solve the problems of the highest scaling applications on the web, because no framework can. If you look anywhere at, like, what's the infrastructure that's running Yahoo or Google or blah, 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 are they using an off-the-shelf framework for this stuff? Of course not. They're rewriting all the super performance critical pieces in something really, really fast and really, really custom and really, really tailored just to their environment. So it was never going to be the job of a generic framework to solve sort of those peak scalability issues. You were always going to farm those out. Just like at Yahoo, they have a ton of infrastructure pieces written in C++, and then they have a ton of customer-facing stuff just written in PHP because the performance of it just doesn't really matter. I mean, that's a good split to go. I don't find that a failure of Rails at all, because, I mean, that would be a failure of web application frameworks in general, because they're just never going to solve that problem.
On your blog recently, you've been posting a series of articles about the myths of Rails. Do you want to address the one or two most important of those? And
Yeah, sure. This is actually a while ago. Let me scroll back and see some of the ones that I'd been talking about. Let's see here. We just had, for a long time, there was just a lot of sort of misconceptions out there. They were either born out of what Rails used to or didn't used to do 5 years ago, or they were born out of just misconceptions entirely. One of them was that Ruby could only speak English, and therefore Rails could only speak English. So if you wanted to make an application that was in any other language than English, you'd be straight out of luck, which is, of course, totally not true. Ruby and Rails speaks UTF-8 just fine. We actually have a really strong internationalization framework built in these days. Absolutely no problems. We're actually currently in the process of experimenting with Basecamp and sending it up to be internationalized and use other languages, and experimenting with that and finding that to be a pretty good experience. Another thing being that Ruby is like a hard language to learn. I think that's so untrue. I find that languages like Java, for example, much harder to learn. I went to a joint degree or a joint college program in computer science and business administration, and I found that there's just so many of my classmates that got turned off programming entirely because it took freaking 25 lines to say hello world in Java. And that's needlessly hard when something like that in Ruby is like puts hello world. Like, how is that harder? So I think that's one of the other myths that are out there. Let's see what else we had. There's just a bunch of myths about how Rails, since we have this whole convention over configuration approach, that you can only use sort of the built-in frameworks that ship with Rails. Well, that's actually not true. We've made a ton of effort, put a ton of effort into, for example, making the template engines we were just talking about, making those pluggable, that you can plug in HAML, you can plug in something else that you want to use. And just because there's a bunch of people who choose not to do that doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means that perhaps the defaults that we've chosen are actually pretty damn good, and you don't need to do it most of the time. But that just gives rise to some of those misconceptions sometimes. I don't think it's really, it's not that big of a problem anymore. We're sort of at the level where Rails is 5 years old. It's sort of proven itself well enough that these things have a tendency not to be that much of a problem. Because a lot of this would come up in discussions in internally in companies. Like, do we want to use Ruby on Rails? Well, I heard it doesn't scale. I heard you can't write it in English. And you don't really have to make logical arguments these days when you can just point to sites. Hey, dude, check out Twitter. Hey, dude, check out yellowpages.com or some sites that internationalized. I mean, they could do it. Obviously, you can too. So I think more than anything, the things that are winning over hearts of sort of the business owners is what are other people doing? And is this happening on other sites, or are other people able to make this work? If so, we can properly make it work too. Which current is why sometimes adoption just takes time.
Current and future Ruby or Rails. I understand you're merging with MIRB or something like that.
Yeah, so MIRB was another Ruby web framework that sort of got developed for a time along very similar lines as Ruby. It was born out of, in some ways, picking a few parts of things that Rails didn't do well at the time and saying, we're going to make a framework that does those things very well. And what we just realized over time was these things were converging. I mean, you had MIRB that was focusing on a number of issues that Rails, for whatever reasons, perceived the real, wasn't doing very well. And then you had Rails that was sort of trying to fix those issues too from another angle. And what we realized was we were working under the same assumptions. We had roughly the same intentions and ideas about what a great framework would be. Wouldn't it just be much easier if we pooled our efforts and all pulled in the same direction? And luckily, that was the conclusion that all the key constituents reached. And we thought, hey, let's just take all the best ideas from MIRB and put them into Rails 3, and we'll be reducing again all the effort of duplicating all the things from the other camp, and we can focus on just moving forward the state of the art and adding more awesome stuff to a key framework. And I think in some ways it is definitely unique for the Ruby community to be able to have sort of such a tight base around something like Rails. It's very unique versus Perl or Python or other languages where you have a lot of different web frameworks that all sort of have some following. In the Ruby world, we really do have a very narrow power band of, there's a bunch of web frameworks in Ruby, but I mean, Rails has a pretty strong hold on the majority of the mindshare in there.
So where do you see Rails in a year or two?
I see it's getting incrementally better. I think I'm not currently seeing any one thing like REST or AJAX on the immediate horizon that's truly going to shake things up in such a way that you can't recognize a Rails application written 1 year from now. Most of the changes that we're making are incremental. We're cleaning up a bunch of things. We're making things faster. We're documenting things better. We're doing all of the sort of polishing parts that, if you just take out one of the things and say, oh, you polished that, well, I guess that's nice, but it doesn't really have that big of an impact. But if you put all these things together, like what's the amount of polish you can put into a year or two worth of effort is going to make a huge deal in the end. Again, it's sort of just like if you're comparing Ruby and Java, like what are the single things you can pull out a single feature? And yeah, that's nice, but it's the sum of the parts. So I think the Rails from a year or two from now is going to be the sum of the parts, not just one major feature we're dying to implement, but all the little things that are going to make things better.
Definitely looking forward to that, David. David, it's been wonderful having you on the show today. I really appreciate taking some time out of your schedule to talk to us about Rails, past, future, and all that sort of stuff. Where can people go to find out more info about Rails?
RubyOnRails.org is the main portal, and we have links to a bunch of other sites from there. All the list of applications is at RubyOnRails.org/applications, which is a good place to start. And RubyOnRails/screencasts is probably the main place to get excited, because you can see somebody build a weblog in 15 minutes and just see all the steps that they sort of go through. And we have a bunch of presentations there. So that's a good place to get started.
And where can people find out more about you if they want to follow you and be a stalker, I guess?
Sure. I have a Twitter page at twitter.com/DHH. I also have a blog that I'm actually not updating that frequently anymore. It's at loudthinking.com. And the main blog that I'm writing on these days is the 37 Sickles blog. It's at 37sickles/SVN. 37sickles.com, that is, /SVN.
Well, David, thank you very much for today's show. I really appreciate it. I know a lot of people are looking forward to this show since we started tweeting about it. Again, thank you for taking your time out of the day.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye now. That was David Hennemeyer Hansen. I probably mangled his last name even after hearing him pronounce it. He's the creator of Ruby on Rails, as you heard. Wonderful speaker. It was great. I love it when I can ask a guest a question and then they just go on for like 20 minutes. Now I know how Leo feels when he's interviewing Steve on Security Now. Very cool. So speaking of upcoming guests, let's look at the big calendar here coming up. We have on the very short list, as in already scheduled, we have Eugene Sendankilenko. I just have a hard time with names. I'm sorry. He's going to be talking about ScumVM, which is the virtual machine that ran all the original Lucasfilm games, LucasArts games. He'll be on in shortly. We also just added to the schedule Michael Ford talking about Iron Python, which is the implementation of Python on .NET. We also have added Eric Jung talking about Foxy Proxy. It's the Firefox installation that lets you run stuff through proxies. But he's actually going to talk more about the idea of anonymization and privacy and all sorts of things. And so he's going to be a real good interview coming up soon. We also have one of the most interesting people who wrote me to ask to be on the show. We have Jeffrey Darlington coming up. He's the guy that does the GPF, the General Protection Fault comics. And he's bringing along a couple of his comics buddies. We're going to have a chat about using open source software to create those things that you see online and maybe even in the newspaper every day. So that'll be a great conversation as well. Short list, we've also got some guys from the OpenStreetMaps, CF Engine, Ganache, and so on. So stick around for the shows that are coming up. You can follow me, speaking of following people, on Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter, M-E-R-L-Y-N. You can also look at our upcoming guest list on the website at twit.tv/floss. And there you'll also find a list of the upcoming people and how to submit new suggestions. So please check the list out. We already still have 150 names on there. I could do Floss Daily and I still wouldn't be done. I just want to make a quick announcement for the other hat that I happen to wear. I'm on the board of directors of Linux Fund, who's been funding open source now for almost a decade. We just recently got approval to have a credit card that has Beastie on it, the BSD logo, and you can have a credit card. And every time you make a purchase, a little bit of that goes into a pool that helps fund other open source projects, such as the ones we've been talking about on Floss Weekly. So that's all there is for that. Next week, I hope Leo is back. But I'm holding down the fort for now. So this is Randall Schwartz signing off. And we'll see you again next time on Floss Weekly.